you people to Starship Rokan Show with Anna DeBlantis off for another week of broadcast insolence, and Anna's back.
Happy Monday, everybody.
The whole cast is together for the first time in 2018.
The cast of Stable Geniuses.
Missed you guys so much.
Missed you too, man.
Missed you.
Love you guys.
Yeah, Stable Geniuses. That's us.
Stable Geniuses.
We're the most stable genius show ever in the history of shows. It's the smartest show ever.
Well, should do the billboards.
You know,
with
he
that.
Doubled down. This is the problem. Saturday morning, so he tweets that out that he's a stable genius. And then at Camp David, he goes into that whole thing about, I went to the best schools, very smart, the best school, great grades. No one can prove that, by the way.
Because we haven't seen him.
But then he goes on to made billions of dollars and had a very, I don't know if people know, but I had a hit television show.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he just described Oprah. I like he calls himself self-made, by the way. That's my favorite part when he says he's a self-made billionaire.
Right. Kind of a guy who was born on third base, but did a lot with it. And
he
know,
did.
I mean, my God, look what he did.
He did. He did. He became
he
president
did.
Of the United States. But that is self-made. You can't just make that. I don't care how much money you got. That doesn't just happen.
No. Oprah's truly self-made.
But he was also willing to play a card that a lot of politicians know is available to them, but thought better than to play.
Mm-hmm.
Because they didn't think it was the right thing, the best thing to do, which is to play the us versus them card to its nth degree.
Yeah.
And it worked. It can work, but it also will have implications down the line as we move forward as a culture and move forward as a, you know, as a nation. Mm-hmm. There are going to be some effects of that, and some of them might be okay, and some of them might not be okay. So
true.
So where's it going to be when the not okay part occurs? So that's kind of a bit of an issue.
With everybody talking about Oprah running for president now, did everyone forget that The Rock, who was there, is actually says that he's a legitimate political candidate? I guess is he out now?
I think he backed off that.
Oh, now, well, kind of like Kid Rock did? The Rock did, too?
I think Kid Rock and The Rock both backed off. I mean, the Kid Rock said the whole thing was just a joke. But
yeah,
I think
right.
The
he
Rock
did.
Is kind of... But what I thought was interesting last night at the Golden Globes, Richard Roberts is going to be here a little bit later on to talk about...
Mm-hmm.
Everything that happened there last night. But it used to be Miss Golden Globe was the
uh-huh.
was the role, and the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, which is a flamboyant group of people. There's like 98 people in this organization.
And you really don't know who they, I mean, they're, no. they're just, they're, some of them are very small papers, and like there's Thailand, there's a representative, and all over the world, right? This is
right.
the foreign press.
There was a guy, I think it was either German or Belgian or something, that mm-hmm. ran it for years and years and years. And basically what it was they started this Golden Globe Award to try to throw a great party.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 75 years ago, that was the whole idea of this. They wanted to work their way into being part of the, you know, the glitterati in Hollywood.
And why wouldn't you want to?
And until about 20 years ago, nobody cared about this. And then TNT put this thing on television. And it was the best part was that they would eat and drink during it, and then the people would get drunk, and then it became a great television show. And then I think Dick Clark Productions owned it for a while, and then NBC took over, and they made it into this.
What was like a boozy award show? You didn't take it seriously,
right? It became the first one. It was boozy, but it was also one of the few that has both radio. Both television and film.
Mm-hmm.
No radio, as far as I can tell.
I think we won something.
Did we? So that's the issue that you know we're now confronted with is that it's now become very corporate and mainstream. But again, it's still the same like 98 people who run the whole deal.
Yeah.
And they vote for it, and sometimes you get some you know weird things. So for years they would include the a daughter of a famous actor or actress
mm-hmm.
to become Miss Golden Globe, and that was another way of sucking up to the Hollywood community is choosing somebody. And you know some of the past Miss Golden Globes were Angelina Jolie.
Yeah, wasn't. Don Johnson and Melanie
yes.
Griffin's daughter.
Right. The
Dakota,
one who's
a very accomplished actress in her own right, right now.
In 50 Shades of Grey.
Yeah.
No, she's been doing some other things too, hasn't she?
Right, she's actually better in the other movies, we're told, than 50 Shades of Grey. But people can't get that out of their head. And now she's in the one where it's going to be all S&M and then some other guy comes back. I don't know. They ran a commercial for it last night. It got a little weird.
But they changed it to Golden Globe Ambassador this year.
Yes.
No longer Miss Golden Globe.
Because they decided that if they're going to do a whole... They're going to stand up to sexism and to abuse and assault and all those things. Mm-hmm. They should probably not put a woman in a sash in front, you know,
and
parade her around like up and down, right, and do the horse walk when you walk up and down with the globe itself, with the award itself. So now she's an ambassador, and this is the first ever ambassador.
Yes, yeah, Sistine Stallone, 19 years old, and the world's ahead of her.
This is the Rock's daughter.
Oh, this was Sylvester Stallone was one of them, wasn't she? Or no, is the Rock's daughter was this
year? Yeah, it was the Rock's daughter.
That's right, the Rock's daughter. It's one of the Stallone daughters did it before too.
Yes, she was the last Miss Golden Globe, the Stallone daughter, and now who, by the way, is making quite a spectacle of herself on the Instagram.
Is she? What's her
yeah?
account? What's her account?
Oh God,
I don't know. There was a story
don't
over the weekend about this, about how it's just a little too much, baby Kate.
His daughters are gorgeous.
They are.
So anyway, so he's got that. So they got all that going. So now all of a sudden she's an ambassador. And it, you know, like 2 weeks ago she was Miss Golden Globe, and now I think she was named as Miss Golden Globe in the fall. And then like 2 weeks ago, no. Now you're an ambassador. You understand?
On that note,
Madam Ambassador.
On that note, you've got to give Seth Meyers credit, because I'm sure if they could have chosen, knowing what the year would be like and seeing it play out in retrospect, they might have chosen a female host, right? And yet he did a good job. It's sort of moving through everything.
Yeah, it was almost like an apology tour, though. I mean, he might as well have just put his junk in a Hillman's bottle and handed it to everybody.
Good evening, right, ladies and remaining gentlemen.
Yes, yeah. It was almost too much of the moment. It was like, I'm very sorry. He was apologizing for every sentence. I would like to apologize in advance for this joke because it's going to be funny, or maybe not, because now I've apologized. I kind of ruined the moment. All right. Well, there's more on this. And the president is speaking. We're going to bring you details if he makes any news. I do firmly believe he'll take a shot at Oprah if he hasn't already.
That's a prediction.
Yeah, to try to push her off the plate.
I don't think
it's never too early for him to be politicking.
She'd be a formidable candidate, I think, in this world where we want superstars and TV stars to be our
I don't think that's an accurate world. It happened, but I don't think it's a world. I think it's more of a. I think it's a. It was a. It was an accident more than it was anything else. It was like
it's a phase in our life.
Yeah, it was a phase. It was, you know, where you do something, and you're like, it made a lot of sense at the time for some people, and then you're like, uh oh.
Let's move on. We grow.
All right. Well, we'll get to all of that, but first, and Tom Skilling's going to join us in just a second to talk about how long this is going to last. This is a good moment.
You missed
a lot of bad moments. This is a good moment. All of that coming your way. But first, Violetta Pondermedics at the WGN Traffic Trouble Spots. Rokan Show with Anna DeVlantis right here on 720 WGN. All right, here he is.
Tom Skilling.
He's our hero.
Guys.
Hi, Tom.
Hello, Anna, and happy Monday, Ro.
Thank you very much.
Happy New Year. I didn't have a chance to say that earlier.
I know.
Nice to hear that
from you, Anna, and right back at you.
You have 2 days left to say it.
That's only 2 days? Mm-hmm. The 9th is the last day?
The 9th. Actually, the 9th is the last day.
I see.
Yeah, once you say it on the 10th, you have gone too far.
Is that the rule? The Rose Rules of Order?
No more Happy New Year, and your Christmas tree and decorations must be down.
Oh, come on. That's too much to ask.
That's good, because mine is shedding needles at home badly.
Right. Have you? Did you not do it yet?
No, not yet. But all the bulbs have come off.
Right.
And we took all the lights off. So
this is the. And then it's just a naked, sad, ugly, dying tree.
Well, and the problem is when it starts drooping, as mine is right now, they've got the ornaments start crashing off to the ground.
Yes.
So, like, you'll hear an ornament.
Do you take the ornament?
And then if you.
Are the ornaments off?
Yes, the ornaments are off.
And the lights are off.
The kitty is finding that in our house, is finding that amusing, as are the dogs.
And the dogs will track the needles around. So will the cat. Because
oh,
the cat will have the needles in the cat's fur at some point.
I know.
His, her, or its fur. And then the and this is invariable. The dogs go and they drink the water out of the bottom of the
water. Oh, gosh. You know.
Right?
Because I think sick.
That, I think, is like either they get sick or they get drunk. I mean, it's a thing.
Well, and after this cold spell, I mean, they've looked at me for a week, all of us, my roommates and all of us, like, you expect us to go out in this, you know, and we put the little jackets on when we can.
Do they blame you like we blame you for this?
Oh, they there's a look in those eyes right there. Yeah,
they know you're in charge of the weather.
The only thing is, it's a mix of sadness and of intolerance,
But there's necessity there, too. So it's sort of like you have to weigh all three.
I know. So we put down these little poop pads, you know, around the place just in case there's an accident. And I find they're being used a little more expeditiously.
Yeah, but then,
what a good idea.
You know? But do they, but you know, once you get them into that habit for a couple of weeks, then you got to break them of that habit.
I know. I wonder how successful we're going to be. But we've had them outside.
I'd leave that up to the other guys. Yeah. I would. I would just go, I know, and I go, listen, I got to go to work.
Yeah.
I don't have time for this.
Yeah, we'll say to.
Do you draw straws in terms of how you decide who's
going to walk the dogs? You know what? I've got to say, my roommates, this burden disproportionately falls on them because I get in late and they get up early. We're, of course, our schedules are all over the map, so we're coming and going. It's basically a product to whoever's available is expected to take them out. But it's really mean to do that to them, but I don't know what else you do.
Hey, listen, as long as it's working out, but you got, now I know you live in an apartment and you live, on a high floor.
Yes.
So my rule about what you do with it as an urban liver, my whole life has always been you just toss the tree out the window and then you go down and you pull it out of wherever it landed and you
that
throw it somewhere.
Safe. Sounds really safe.
Well, I'll tell the authorities in our condo association that, that you gave us the okay.
I grew up on the 20th floor.
All right. We're 19.
Yeah. So I couldn't do it as a kid, but then we had artificial trees as a kid because my mom didn't want to deal with the leaves.
Well, that's
a
good idea.
The needles.
That's sounding more and more reasonable. Every
well, it was.
Year,
but what's
you know?
The floor that of which after you pass, you can no
so
longer.
Third, I so dump. I lived in a six flat for a while, and I lived on the top floor of the six flat. Mm-hmm. So that I figured was okay. Three stories, and there was parking spaces below.
Sure.
Off your back deck kind of thing, off your back, the kitchen entrance.
Yeah. Sure.
And, it's kind of fun. Like, just as long as you've cleared that nobody else is walking around down there.
You have to do that.
That's when Tori was eight, I'd send her down to make sure there's nobody down there. All right, step back! And then you throw
really
the thing
far
over.
Far back.
Yeah.
Boy, I'll tell you, I bet the needles came off that thing when it hit, coming off there.
Oh, well, yeah.
You know, the thing is, we figure when we win the lottery, the first thing we're going to do is we're going to put a dog elevator right down to the little pen down below.
A dog walk area down there?
Yeah, there's a dog walk outside our building.
But does it have a basket, like in Rear Window, where the woman had a basket and a rope, and she would lower the dog until that something bad happened to the dog?
I couldn't do that. Yeah. Did you hear that horrible story last week?
Huh.
Don't bring us down.
Oh, this was terrible. Somebody left their little dog out on the porch.
I hate that.
And it was, isn't that, what a horrible way.
Not to compare the mammals, but do you see the story that rats are dead in the street from freezing to death?
It got so cold that rats are dying.
Wow.
And I thought they survived everything.
Right.
I know.
This just tells you everything you need to know about how bad this thing could be.
Yeah.
It could get bad.
You know, and some people have written to say, hey, this will take care of some more of the mold this year and some of the, pests that come back to haunt us again in the warm season. I don't know if that's true or not, but hey, it sounds reasonable.
Only Chicagoans could find something positive that brutal, brutal cold.
Well, on the other, did you guys hear what's going on in Australia? They had the hottest temperature ever in one of Sydney's suburbs, 117 degrees over the weekend.
Oh,
they have wildfires going, and this covers a huge swath of the country. And they've got ozone advisories and all kinds of power outages as a result of the strain on the grid. So isn't that something that one... And, you know, somebody sent me a picture from San Francisco over the weekend where it was in the 70s. So, what a variety of weather we've got going.
Yeah. And then in Florida, there were those pictures of the iguanas freezing.
Right. Dropping off the trees.
that was a visual.
Look at an iguana. It's like, listen, My whole life I've been an iguana. And I never had to deal with this kind of crap. And now look what's happening.
I know. But you know,
what am I supposed to do? My eye is stuck. My eye is stuck.
Oh, poor thing.
The only thing is, Ro, they say that they're stunned. They aren't actually dead. They drop out of the trees.
Oh, good.
And they lay there and they look dead. Mm-hmm. But they said if people will drag them into the sun, they'll come back. What's that, Anna?
I know the feeling. I felt that way, too, walking out in some of this.
That's a good point.
Oh, my God. All right. So how long is this this little thing that you ordered up going
to
last?
Well, this is nice. I mean, we'll be up to 49 Wednesday, 52 Thursday, and then Thursday afternoon and night, the bottom drops out again. Now, we've got a respectable cold surge coming down this weekend into early next week. But by the middle of next week, we're already above normal again, and the next warm-up comes. So this one won't last as long. However, it'll be...
But is it going to be like it was? Like
it won't be quite as
single
bad.
Digits in teens?
There could be some single digits at night, And there might even be local areas that go below zero, but it only will last for a couple of days. This isn't going to be a long one.
Really?
And let's see. We've got 21 on Saturday, 18 Sunday and Monday. And then we go, back to 10 or more degrees above normal by Friday, Saturday next week, which would translate to temperatures back well into the 40s again. So this is, in fact, that's the way it looks now for the next 2 weeks. Like, we're going to have these cycles where we go from Arctic to Pacific air, and they'll be rather jarring changes.
I got to tell you, though, you called it. This is exactly what you called.
The only thing is, Ro, this cold season has surprised me at how little precipitation we've had. I would have thought we had above normal precip.
Don't say that out loud.
I know.
It's enough.
You know the other shoe
has got to drop. It was fun. It was white over Christmas. It was fine.
It was.
It's good. That's all I need.
Thank you, Ro.
It's January.
That.
This is, after January 15th, I declared spring around here, and I'm waiting for the thaw.
Oh, gee.
Well,
we're 2 weeks away, and we got a break here, but we're 2 weeks away, because Judy's waiting for the news, from the bottom of the winter trough.
That's true. Saturday, a week from Saturday, is the last, the coldest day, and the average temperature starts up after that.
Yep, there you go.
And the days are getting longer.
There you go.
Albeit slowly at this point, but that'll
still. Hey, it's still something, Tom.
That's
very
right.
Positive.
You got it right.
And then by the end of this month, it'll be getting dark at 5 o'clock, and then the end of next month, the end of February into March, then it'll be at like 6:30, and then 2 weeks into that, we change the clocks, and we're out of this thing.
I know.
Did you see what I did there? I got a plan.
Like
I got a plan.
You
like
have raised
too.
Our spirits with that single utterance.
And then this week, we're just buying, it's a couple days off of what it could have been.
Yeah.
So we got to look at it.
Who knew you could be so positive, bro?
I know.
This is a big moment.
Yeah.
Wow. I'll tell you, I'm really impressed. I feel better already.
There you go.
How
I'm like Oprah.
You,
I'm your Oprah. I did what Oprah did for the nation last night,
you
I'm doing for Chicago.
For us. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Ro
Oprah.
Thank you, Tom.
All right. See you guys.
Ro-Oprah. Right.
Ro-Oprah.
All right. Here's Judy Pilak. She's got the WGN News right now.
We're streamlining regulations that have blocked cutting-edge biotechnology, setting free our farmers to innovate, thrive, and to grow. Oh, are you happy you voted for me? You are so lucky that I gave you that privilege. The other choice wasn't going to work out too well for the farmers, I hate to.
Hello.
You know what I like about him? Is he's modest. I think that's the
humble,
best part of
very humble.
Humble. Doesn't take himself too seriously, which I like. I like that.
The stable genius.
How? I like that he has done. What exactly has he done? He's signed a few executive orders, right? He made sure that the watering holes are not navigable waterways.
Well, I think he's saying his greatest accomplishment is the economy is steaming full, steam ahead, and that he's a part of that optimism because he's a pro-business kind of guy.
Mm-hmm. Aren't you glad you voted for me? I don't know. We'll have to see what the I'm as grateful for the economy as ever because I did my end of the year recap, and if you own stocks, it went well. If you own stocks, it was good.
Mm-hmm.
And
at our holiday party, two of their relatives were saying that they both got raises, and one of them was able to get one of those $1,000 bonuses that was handed out. So they were pretty happy with the way things
tax
are going.
Thing, right. So that is a good. So he takes the credit for it, as every president does in their first year, And that's the way it's going to be.
That's the way it goes.
That's the way it's going to be. And it's fine. I mean, listen, that's great. If it just stays like this and we don't have thermonuclear war and we don't have race riots in America and okay. And he cures the opioid crisis.
Mm-hmm. Not going to get as well, I don't think, but that's on the agenda now. But they're shifting over to infrastructure and immigration and the wall.
Mm-hmm. Congressman Kinzinger is going to join us in just a second.
Remember.
A.B. Stoddard is joining us. Happy New Year, A.B. Thank you for being with us.
Happy New Year to both of you.
Thank you. I'd like to just play something for you. We all heard this over the weekend, but it bears repeating.
I went to the best colleges or college. I had a situation where I was a very excellent student, came out, made billions and billions of dollars, became one of the top business people, went to television, and for 10 years was a tremendous success, as you probably have heard, ran for president one time and won. And then I hear this guy that doesn't know me at all. By the way, did not interview me for three. He said he interviewed me for 3 hours in the White House. It didn't exist. Okay. It's in his imagination.
Okay. You know, normally when you hear somebody listing that sort of accomplishment, they're introducing someone to
someone else.
To someone else.
Not right? Talking about themselves.
Right. At a dinner, at an award ceremony. It's like they're introducing. He's introducing himself. It kind of goes against it. It's so cringeworthy that it's like, oh, no. I mean, and you wonder, even to the most dedicated Trump supporter, does that person stop and go, maybe, I don't know. It's even a little creepy. It's creepy.
I just want us all to concur that the Republican congressman standing behind him, along with members of the cabinet, are earning every penny.
Oh, you know,
I was looking at them.
Kevin McCarthy.
The poker faces.
The whole
right.
Time.
Kevin McCarthy. Well, first of all, you know, Mike Pence has perfected this great, like, lock-jawed. But it's just an earnest expression, you know.
Mm-hmm,
he kind of clenches
mm-hmm.
He purses his lips together, and he squints his eyes, and it's almost like he's, you know, like he's almost going to squeeze off a tear. You know, it's like that kind of a thing.
Yes, George Will had this description of it. I have to memorize it. It was in a column more than a year ago, and it was genius. And it is this combination of sort of earnest appreciation mixed with sadness.
Right,
it's sort of like
almost
a wistfulness for times past, and I wish this were only true. That kind of a moment, and then Kevin McCarthy, uh-huh. who was standing behind him, and Kevin McCarthy, who was like an up and coming guy. Kevin McCarthy is likely a guy to run for speaker if something politically should befall mm-hmm. the current Speaker of the House, which I think is kind of likely this year, or he'll step aside saying, I never really want to do this in the first place. So Kevin McCarthy doing it almost like he's looking at Mike Pence and trying to do that expression. Like, yes. I'm going to copy your facial expression now. Hold on, I'm going to do this. Because there's no way that at any person who was raised in this culture can sit there behind, I think in any culture, let alone this one, but this is one of the more braggadocious cultures on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
It's that, but even here, where we do have a tendency to thump our own chests, even that is too much. Even that is like, it's like, who's going to sit back there and go, yep, absolutely. Yes, right, sir.
Well, the only defense I saw of it that was somewhat interesting and maybe a little bit compelling was John Sununu, the former chief of staff under George H.W. Bush, said that he grew up in Queens, and that was surprised me, but that the Trump also grew up about not very far away from where he did, and that that's how it was when they grew up, that they all boasted about themselves, slammed anybody who slammed them, and that was the culture that he grew up in. Now, should that change when you become a president?
Oh, come on.
Obviously, I think most of us would agree it should.
Come on.
But that's what his...
But, I mean, that's, you know, it's of a piece and a pattern, and he's, you know, he brags about this all the time. He got up in the National Prayer Breakfast last February. I was there. And he asked for prayer for Arnold Schwarzenegger's ratings because they were doing so badly.
Right.
I mean, he brags about his accomplishments all the time, but that morning of all mornings, when it was post-Michael Wolff book, huge firestorm, and the very stable genius tweet storm at Camp David. And then they all had to sort of gather around and talk about real important stuff and keep those stone faces on stage. It's so surreal. If you had told us a year ago that that would happen, we would say, no, there's no way.
Well, how about any of us standing there? Could you have held that face? I mean, if someone said, I'll pay you $1 million just to stand there and act like it's just normal.
Yeah.
Could you do it?
I would have done that thing
Camp David.
Where you do that thing with your hand, where you make your hand talk, you know, like a puppet, you know, and I've just and rolled my eyes and done that right behind him for, and then have me executed. There's a thing here, though, that I think is starting to turn. It's going to be interesting that the Oprah, everybody's so gaga over Oprah and her speech last night, which was a spectacular speech, but it in and of itself is not a campaign. In and of itself does not make her president. You know, there's a lot of things here, but people are starting to speculate about whether or not she wants to be president. Apparently, two sources confirm that she's thinking about it. You know, that's Gail and Steadman right there.
There are
only two sources in her life, and those are the two.
This is true.
Right? So that's it. And they both said it sort of flippantly, you know, offhandedly to reporters after this. So it doesn't really mean a lot, but there is only a matter of time before the president's going to go after her. Because as soon as somebody puts out an instant poll over the next day or two, like Oprah versus Trump, because someone will have to do that.
Yes.
And she beats him, and it'll be tight. It won't be, you know, because the Trump partisans, that's their worst nightmare is Oprah, right? It couldn't be worse. But there are going to be some. This kind of the conservative suburban mom that everybody's talking about, you know, we used to call them the soccer moms and all that, and security moms. That demographic seems to be a little turned off by behavior like we just played. And maybe Oprah's a little more to their liking. But I still think, you know, right now in a kind of this blindish poll, maybe it's 55-45 or, you know, 52-48 or something like that. And he's going to go nuts. He's going to go if he doesn't beat
him by
10 points.
It really is an interesting concept, because it's true. Anything that sort of resembles the whiff of an actual competition or, you know, one-on-one, you know, juxtaposition is something that, you know, always usually prompts tweets. But he people have already found tweets from him in the past saying she's a winner, she's going to be great, you know. That she, I guess years ago he said she should, you know, she would be his VP pick.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So there's always a tweet for that, as we like to say. But it is a really a weird thing, because I agree with you. You know, the speech is compelling. She's a compelling orator. She knows how to do it, whatever. But this idea of because of Trump, therefore Oprah, or Mark Cuban, or, you know, that we have to go to the next TV star, is not going to be so exciting to many, many people who think, I think we've done TV star.
Well, okay, so I should tell this story, because this does give some context. I think this is a pretty telling thing. I appear regularly on a TV show that replaced Oprah here in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And we did an Insta poll this morning about that, or this afternoon, about that. And the And only 61%, and this is where you call in poll, right? So those are based on people's passions. That has nothing to do with, we know, that's not scientific in any way, shape, or form. And so 61% said yes, they would vote for her.
I'm surprised it's that low.
Wow. Right. In a very, very pro Oprah audience, right? It's a show designed very much to capture that audience. And it was kind of a moment, even where the erstwhile host of the show was like, what? Really? What? 61%? Wow. Yeah. And I think the answer to that is very simple, which is that America, if we choose in 20, I may not be here for it, but if we choose in 20, I mean, he may throw me out of the country. I may have to escape the gulag, but in 2020 is if he runs, which is still kind of an if. I think if he loses, it will be about, even in the primary, it'll be about, we need a professional to do this, which will be an honest, really interesting and honest turn away from this whole idea of, let's just have somebody who makes us feel better or makes us, you know, draws our attention.
Mm-hmm.
I know. It really is going to be interesting whether or not there's, you know, this whole populist Bannonism, and it's not even Trumpism, because depending on the day, he's a globalist, he's a nationalist, he's everything in between, but sort of the Bannon strain of what was to be the Trumpian populism is a rejection of mastery, a rejection of expertise, a rejection of professional politicians, all this stuff, professional legislators. And I wonder if it's going to be... it's open season now, and there are new rules and new criteria, so it can be a TV star just as long as they're really, really different from Trump, or if it's going to be, we need a serious person who's qualified at this actual job of governance.
Well, if there's a crisis.
And leading the free world, and something had to prepare you besides television.
Yeah, if there's a crisis, and the crisis is blamable on inexperience, mm-hmm. or is not handled well, you know, is this something totally unrelated, but it's not handled well by the administration. I mean, it could be a significant, you know, those are the kind of things that in everyday politics occur. And so we'll just have to see. And there will be crises. I mean, the thing is, things happen, and things happen on a national scale. And I just cannot imagine that the Dow is going to continue to go up forever. It can't. I mean, when it does have a natural... I think the American economy, the way the structure is set here, and he's done some things that I think are very, very good in this. But there's a piper to be paid at the end of this, which is how much money will there be when the economy turns and we have to start paying some of the bills on this? How detrimental will that be? But that's down the line. He's not going to think about it. He won't be here for that. And so potentially. So then the question is, people will look back on this moment and we will laugh. Anna, we will laugh. We will replay whether it's in 2 years or 10 years or whatever it is, we're going to replay that thing about a guy patting himself on the back for being a genius, and generations will go, are you kidding me?
That didn't happen.
Right. So
I love that you're confident enough to think that we'll all still be here. But anyway.
Yeah, I know. Those of us who are not glowing or...
What I think is interesting, actually, just going back to Trump quickly about the markets, is that is his favorite selling point. And I believe that there right now he's trying to renegotiate NAFTA and make changes and everything. And really, you know, he's really like picking up the table and turning it upside down. That's what he wants to do anyway. He wants to confront the Chinese. He wants steel tariffs. And it's so interesting because, and when he threatens the North Koreans with his big button on Twitter and stuff, the people around him use the stock market as a calming discussion where you don't want to rattle the stock market if you go too wild on Twitter with Kim Jong-un. You don't want to rattle the stock market if you break out of this agreement that the Mexicans and the China and the Canadians want to stay in with us, and if we confront the Chinese with in terms of steel and a big trade war, that is the way to circle back.
Yeah.
To what he sees as one of his greatest accomplishments.
Yeah, which is, by the way, why Bannon did have to go away, because he did imperil the stock market. We'll see. We'll see what happens here. AB, thank you very much. Appreciate
Thanks,
it.
AB
Stoddard.
Thanks so much, guys.
Real Clear Politics. Violetta Podramatic. Real Clear Traffic. Rokan Show with Anna DeBlancis right here on 720 WGN. That music can mean only one thing.
Yes.
Congressman Adam Kinzinger.
Joining us.
Is joining us, even though that's a movie about the Navy. He's Air Force. It bothers me more than it bothers him. All right. Let's talk. Let's see. So did you start back at work today? Did you guys, as Congress, get back in today?
I just got here. It's amazing.
It's beautiful, isn't it? What a great town.
How cold is it there, Congressman? Is it okay?
It's actually a little colder than Illinois, but I mean, this week it's supposed to be in the like 40s or 50s, and I think it's probably going to be warmer in Illinois too, but yeah, Illinois wins today in the weather war against D.C., that's rare.
Right. Do we have to have number one. We have to have a weather war about that too.
We have to. Well,
everything's a war.
Yeah. Why can't we just get along? We're America, man. Why can't we just go, hey, we're all okay. Hey, all right, let's talk about a couple things. Now that you guys are back there, you got the tax thing done. And that was a big piece at the end of the year. The president did spend some time trying to make people regret for voting for it by talking about how smart he was. Mm-hmm. But now there's a couple other legislative things that are going to hit the fan here. Now, the there's a looming government shutdown, right? I mean, it's, we've got...
Always is.
Right, there always is. So we're, what, 2 weeks away from that, potentially, if you guys don't vote on a plan here. Although, I guess you could push it again, right? Theoretically?
Yeah, in theory. I think this is going to be the showdown date, though, to be honest with you.
All right. So let's talk about what has to happen here. Obviously, Democrats, you're going to need 60 votes in the Senate for part of this, right? So, and that's to avert the shutdown. So Democrats want some kind of a decision here on DACA, which is basically the deferment for the deferred action for the children of people who've come over, you know, illegally and brought them when they were under 18. Do you think that, and you know, you're dealing with the numbers float on this, but you know, there are probably a million of these kids in America, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
So, do you think there can be a bipartisan solution here?
I do. You know, the president has said that he actually wants to fix the DACA situation, but he says he also wants his border security money. I actually think that's reasonable to say, hey, DACA for border security. Border security.
But he says wall, though. There's a difference between saying border security and wall.
I think at this point it's security. There's going to be a wall in some areas and then security in other. I mean, I think it's coming down to basically a virtual wall. I don't think there's many people left that think there's going to be a wall for, you know, 3,000 or 4,000 miles. But you compare walls in some areas with technology, et cetera. But I don't think it's an unreasonable request. I mean, I've tried to kind of figure out how my colleagues on the other side of the aisle can argue against beefing up border security. And it's not just an issue of immigration. It's an issue of drugs and everything else. Right. So, you know, but there's also other dynamics at play. So, you know, can we get to a DACA plus border security piece? I think possibly. But the other dynamics.
Okay, I want to stop you right there for a second because what you just said is very reasonable. It's almost Oprah-esque. I think
it's a new day.
Winfrey Kinzinger. I see that as a ticket in 2020. But he wants $18 billion, and he says for the wall. What you did is you framed it in a way that I think most Americans and most people on Capitol Hill would have an argument, would have trouble arguing against, which is we want border security for all of these reasons. Mm-hmm. A wall is a component. There's also technological overlay. But for him to stand by his campaign rhetoric, he's asking for $18 billion that theoretically the Mexicans should be paying for. And only his most fervent supporters would be the ones that would have to, you know, be mad at him about not getting Mexico to pay for it. And I think that Steve Bannon has taken those people on a little bit of a hiatus. So I guess the question is, is this the new language that you just used? Is this going to be the new language for trying to get a bipartisan bill through?
Maybe. If it is, it's not any language I've been handed. So if people are listening to this interview and they like it, maybe they'll start using it. Okay. But no, I think, to build a wall again, to build a 3,000-4,000-mile wall along the border, totally nonstop, is not realistic. It's not even possible. And, you know, even Border Patrol has said, like, look, we want to actually be able to see through the wall because you got to see what's on the other side. But there are some areas where it works. Now, is this the new mantra? I don't know. We're just getting back here. I'm not sure what's going to be said. But I think there's a lot of people in the president's inner circle on the Republican side and, frankly, on the Democratic side that understand that, you know, border security is not a perpetual wall. And I get what he said in the campaign, and maybe he thought he could do it. But the reality is we can secure the border without building a 3,000-mile wall. In fact, we can probably put a significant amount of money and actually make it more effective than just a wall. You do that with technology. You do that with fencing in some areas and everything else and extra Border Patrol agents. So, again, I mean, the question is really what this all comes down to. We've descended to such tribalism in this country that nobody's really willing to listen to the other side of the aisle. It's all just we want 100% or it's a loss. Mm-hmm. And are we willing to take 80% victories on both sides? And then I think we can come to a conclusion.
I guess that's the question, too, because you see Democrats saying, well, we just would really like to see some protections put in place for the DACA immigrants, the children of immigrants brought here. And then the president says there will be no DACA negotiations without a wall. And so it feels as if these two issues are necessarily linked. Is that the way you see it?
Well, because his term is wall, though, right? Isn't that the issue?
He says wall.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's the issue. I gotta throw a little shade at the other side of the aisle on this, and I try not to just be a partisan. But, you know, look, if the president has said he wants to do something about DACA, Take him at his word. Work with us to do something. I've said I wanted to do something about DACA. The vast majority of Republicans want to do something about DACA. Only the most kind of extreme fringe on immigration issues, you know, want to deport the people that only know the United States of America as their home country, especially in a point when we're approaching a labor shortage. But, you know, that said, so the Democrats have got to be willing to work with this president. You're not going to get a victory without giving something up. And it's the same thing I would say to my Republican friends. Unfortunately, we need 60 votes in the Senate. We're not going to get, you know, border security without giving something to the Democrats on immigration. We can solve this issue. It's an 80% issue when you say, you know, look, put your hand on the heart, pledge allegiance to the United States of America, all these issues. People are like, yeah, that's totally reasonable. But we always talk past each other.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen. Sounds like it.
I got to say.
I'm afraid you're right now.
Yeah. As stable geniuses, as we all are.
A group
are.
Of more stable geniuses you will be hard to find. Stabler geniuses, is that the way to say it?
Yes. And I went to the finest schools, at least I think I did. All right, so let's move on from this. I kind of assume that something is going to get worked out there and that the cooler heads are going to prevail. All right, something that I know that you're is near and dear to your heart, which is obviously international security. Now, North Korea, you got the Olympics looming as well, a couple weeks away from the opening ceremonies there. The North Koreans and South Koreans are getting together to talk about this, including maybe even doing a joint women's hockey team, which I think is kind it's interesting. I think it's kind of fascinating. The president's taking credit for creating enough tension in this that it's requiring these two sides to get together. He might be right about that, but he certainly did. Are you optimistic that some form of negotiation can begin here with the Koreans, North Koreans?
No. I'm hopeful. I'm not optimistic. And, you know, we've been down this road 100 times. And, you know, every time, even if there ends up being some breakthrough deal, you think Clinton in 1994, President Clinton was hours away from bombing North Korea. And, or actually, I guess maybe days away from bombing North Korea. And then, you know, Jimmy Carter went and claimed he had this massive breakthrough, which ended up leading to a nuclear North Korea, where we're at today. So I'm not convinced that this is going to lead to a breakthrough. I think it's a good thing, though. I think people need to see that diplomacy has a chance to work. I think it's good that the president said he'd be willing to talk to Kim Jong-un on the phone. But I think the bottom line of this is, I do think the administration – I'll tell you, it's been interesting to me because I've watched the news and people kind of act like the president has no idea what he's doing on North Korea. I have met with the president on North Korea. I met with him about a month ago. And this guy knows this issue inside and out, and he actually knows foreign policy more than people give him credit for. And I think in this issue, people may not like his tweets on North Korea. I don't like his tweets generally, but on North Korea and some of these other things, I think he has put enough pressure on North Korea that has led to this. Hopefully it's a breakthrough, but if it's not, I think we can at least say we've done everything possible to try to solve this peace.
Well, South Korea is well motivated here. They're putting on the Olympics, and they don't want North Korea ruining their party, and if there's a way to keep that from happening, they would like to they'd like to find a way. And I don't know but it might be giving the Koreans more, right? Koreans kind of have the North Koreans have them over the barrel a little bit on this.
Yeah, I think I think we have to, any kind of negotiation outside of a military action is not going to be just a win for us and a complete loss for North Korea. There'll have to be some kind of a win for North Korea. Maybe that's the statement that we're not looking to reunify the Korean Peninsula. Maybe it's something with China. That's preferable to a war. But the reality is, the one thing we cannot accept is allowing North Korea to have a full nuclear arsenal, because now you have to allow Iran and any other country that wants it, and you've in effectiveness thrown out the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty for the world. And in the long arc of history, 100 years from now, that would be very devastating looking back.
Right, well,
it would.
Not happy about
some food for thought on this Monday.
Any of these, yeah, exactly. Well, I think that's the thing.
Chew on that for a little bit.
Well, I think that this does. It's one of those things that we didn't, and I believe it's part of the reckless nature of the president's thumbs, that we now talk about nuclear conflict as though it is a reality and not. Since I was a kid, have we talked about that?
Yeah.
You know, when we were all worrying about you know, Russia and Reagan and let the bombing begin and all that sort of stuff in the early 80s, you know, it seemed like, especially after the fall of the Soviet Union, that you know, America could, you know, go on and not worry about, and we don't teach too much about what the actions are and what the response is going to be. And now you see the story today that the CDC is going to be putting out protocols in the aftermath of a nuclear attack. And I know we've thought about that in terms of, you know, rogue terrorist acts, a dirty bomb, or but this, yeah, you know, this idea of an air blast, you know, at 30,000 feet over the middle of the United States would take down the grid and create nuclear fallout throughout the Midwest. And, you know, I mean, it's, you know, those kinds of things are being talked about now, and it's disconcerting. And then the president being, you know, sort of flippant, if you will, about that on Twitter, seems to be, it's disconcerting.
Yeah. It's disconcerting. Yeah, I mean, the way we talk about nukes now is disconcerting. But you think about it this way, you know. And again, as I've said, I'm no fan of the president's Twitter. I wish they could take it away from him. but the area where I don't think it's necessarily all that bad is the North Korean issue. Now, I didn't like the "my button's bigger than yours" tweet. Okay, I didn't like that. But at the same time, how many times does Kim Jong-un threaten to wipe the United States off the map? And I think there's a point to say, all right, you know, I get, we've let you say this all the time. Just remember, we actually would win any conflict. Now, maybe the president didn't say that artfully.
Can you write that for him? That would be fine. But he doesn't want, yeah. But I mean, that's, it kind of goes to the nature of, I mean, listen, and Saturday morning when he got up at Camp David, and poor Kevin McCarthy and poor Mike Pence had to sit back there and keep a stone face while he was literally doing something that you know, sometimes you see animals in the zoo do to themselves and you're embarrassed by it. It was a very weird moment, and you know, we've gotten just kind of used to that, and it doesn't seem to be befitting the office of the presidency. I know you've talked about that in the past, but it is what it is. And so I just don't want us to be, I think America agrees with this. They don't want us to blunder ourselves into something because president can't stop bragging about himself. And he's so, yeah, his insecurity overwhelms him at times, and he has to blurt out what is in the front of his brain. I know a lot of people want to make this into, I know the surrogates on cable news, you know, want to make this about, you know, about him. This really is a part of his plan. It is not a part of his plan. You can see it. There's no plan on earth that would be drawn up that would call for this, because it just sends his people going crazy every day trying to clean up the mess. And he's got enough. It is serious stuff. And he's got a good thing going right now in a lot of respects. The economy is humming. The stock market is doing well. He has a very soft bed in which to lie in. And if he wants to get infrastructure done, he's got a good place to start. He's got the DACA and the wall and the, you know, these other pieces. It's all fine. The problem he has set, though, is it's going to be very hard for Republicans like yourself, Congressman, and other conservatives moving forward to be able to make the same economic arguments that you have made for, not you, but Republicans have been making for the last 50 years. That those arguments now have to be redesigned around the voting record, right? Because this isn't about deficits and debt and all of that. This is about you know, we're going to spend our way out of we're spending our way out of a really great market, right? out of an ascending economy, and it doesn't make a ton of sense, because when the crisis starts, I happen to believe everything I know. You know, about the world I've learned from the musical theater. And Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, I know there's some story in the Bible, but whatever, is an amazing story, right? Actually, the story of Joseph in the Bible is an amazing story, because it is about a guy who was perceived to be the enemy of the state, was brought in because he was super smart, like the president is, super smart, to come in and say, you know what? What we might want to think about is what happens when there's a drought. What happens when the economy goes down? Mm-hmm. How are we going to protect ourselves against that by planning for it today? And I just think I wish there were more people on, you know, in the White House that could stop and say, listen, here's what we need to do. I know it's great to give people a bunch of goodies, but we need to plan for what happens when this thing turns, because if you've overspent, you could topple a cart. And there's no reason to do that. So I'd like you to...
I fully agree, and 75% of spending is not even controlled by Congress. That needs to be addressed. And the other side of the aisles claim that we're taking stuff away from people whenever we do that. And I also think to claim that in a descending economy, which inevitably will happen, we have cycles here, mm-hmm. that the government should take more of people's money is not an argument that works overly well. So I think it'll be... I agree, and I think we need to look long-term at some more structural issues, not just in spending, but in society, whether it's welfare and everything else, to help people to achieve their full potential, because everybody has full potential, and we just have to – that's the role of government.
Well, hey, you said it. There's a labor crisis that is looming now. I like to use the word looming. I get paid $5 every time I say it by the looming industry. it's the damnedest thing. It's like, you know, we're in a situation – And again, as you mentioned, DACA and some of these other things, there might be a way. If we had not run a set of politics here that were really about villainizing, not just vilifying, but villainizing those who have come up here for the jobs and the opportunity and didn't obey the laws, we would be in a it would be a little easier to try to create a circumstance where we wouldn't have this. Because you know the major cities. I'm telling you, you cannot get stuff done in the city of Chicago without people who are of questionable immigration status. You just can't. I mean, on a sort of a mean, and I mean that in the right. in the numerical sense, mm-hmm. in the aggregate sense, in the city of Chicago, at the very at the basic level of labor to get mm-hmm. workmen is very, very hard.
It is.
So, we good luck, pal. That's all I'm going to say
Thanks.
To you. Welcome back to Washington.
It'll be great. Let's just keep the government open first. That's the first goal.
Yes. All right. Well, good luck to you on that. We'll talk to you before that all happens. It's all on you, pal. That's all I'm going to say.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks,
goodbye.
Congressman.
If it doesn't work out, it's Kinzinger's fault. What? No! All right. Thanks.
Yeah.
All right. Violetta Pydermedic's got the WGN Traffic Trouble Spots.
Good evening, ladies and remaining gentlemen. I'm Seth Meyers, and I'll be your host tonight. Welcome to the 75th annual Golden Globes, and Happy New Year, Hollywood. It's 2018. Marijuana is finally allowed, and sexual harassment finally isn't.
That joke was written... last week and uh-huh. clearly wasn't fact checked because the Justice Department just made marijuana illegal again the day before.
I know.
So I don't know where he was on
that. Amy Poehler and Tina Fey helped influence some of his. Did you see them in the credits at the end too? Kind of helped with his monologue and everything. I thought he did a nice job. I mean, it was a tough year to do it, right?
There's a couple of things that I thought were, yes, very tough year, for sure.
Don't you think?
But it was almost like he was apologizing for every joke before he could actually deliver the joke. Richard Roper is here with us to discuss. Mm. And I did like this. They never raised the music to play off somebody if it was a woman accepting an award.
Talking about
guys were like, I would like to thank him. And all of a sudden, the orchestra is blaring and trying to get it because they were so behind on time because everybody was going long.
Guillermo del Toro, who won for Best Director, was like, my saint did the mother always believe.
I wanted to hear that.
Kirk Douglas, told a story about.
They should have played him.
Oh, God. God love him. But, he's talking about how, the early stages of the Civil War and a fine reminiscence and played him off.
What was the reaction like to Natalie Portman? And it seemed like, her saying, here are the male nominees for the Best Director. It seemed like some people were like, okay, good. She's highlighting the issue, but maybe taking away from the award.
Yeah, I thought so. And I love Natalie. Portman.
She's one of my favorites.
One of the most intelligent and thoughtful actresses and great talent. But I thought it was poor timing because it was just after such an emotional moment, too. And Ron Howard's up there, who's been nothing but one of the finest gentlemen Hollywood has ever
known.
He didn't pick the director. And she's like, the five men, Opie. why did Opie have to be a boy?
Richard
Cunningham. What about that? How come Chachi didn't love Joni just as much? Why did Joni love Chachi? He's just like, but they're already been picked.
Yeah.
I don't, what can I do now?
Barbara Streisand made the point, though, by saying that she was the best director in first in 34 years.
She's the only female director. Years. Which, you know, ironically enough, sadly enough, you know, she won for Yentl, and she didn't, she shouldn't have won.
Right.
That's not her best.
Well, Prince of Tides. I mean, I think, they didn't they screw around Prince of Tides?
Yeah.
Or was that before or after? I can't remember.
Sure,
but there was
the order, yeah.
But, well, the first of all.
But Yentl is not the greatest film of all time, you know.
The Hollywood Foreign Press is an interesting, we talked about this a little bit earlier. Mm. It's a handful of people who vote on this thing.
90. That's it.
And there is, and it's not a, and it's, and often they will choose things that are controversial for the controversy. Mm-hmm. They've built a beautiful television show around it because they get all the television and film stars in one room together. One of the few places where they do that. Screen Actors Guild Awards does that, but they're not as widely viewed. And that's there's true. Drinking, and it's fun, and mm-hmm. it's got this
television,
kind of
film,
right? Raucous kind of thing going on. So
well, normally it's fun.
Normally, yeah, that's true. Yeah. It seemed like the champagne was in a sparse supply last night, didn't it? Normally, you see like the upturned bottles, you know, like
you
the
do.
Dead soldiers on all the tables, and it seemed like they were a little low on that.
Well, guys know after a few drinks they might hit on somebody, and they don't want to do that in the middle
this
of
event.
This is the wrong time
wrong
to
room.
Do that. Yeah,
wrong
yeah. They did
room.
Not have like the Cosby teeny on the menu this year. You know,
no.
Too soon, but bro, you're very right. Very quickly, you know, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association. It's 90 members, worldwide journalists. All you have to do is have 4 articles published in any given year. And years ago, there was exposés where they found people working in garages and stuff who were members. So you only need like 20 some votes, and certain actors do a beautiful job of courting the HFPA and get like James Franco. They love James Franco. He was not the best actor in anything this year. God love him. And years ago, the Globes were so disgraced, they didn't even have a television home, but they did a beautiful job of resurrecting it, getting the reputation back on track, and getting all the stars. The publicist decided this was going to be a big deal.
Because it's the first one in,
and it
creates momentum for the Oscars.
Mm-hmm. It absolutely does, and now it really matters. It's
the
second biggest award ceremony to the Oscars.
Yeah.
In terms of viewership, and even a lot of actors, I mean, they'll tell you how much they love, you know, the Grammys are huge, of course, and a Tony, but the Golden Globe, man, it's right there in the obit if you win one in the opening
line. No question.
Line, you know?
Yeah.
Does that really influence, though, other people who vote on awards? Or, I mean, why does it seem to be a precursor in some ways?
Even though it is a smaller group, and almost no overlap, if any,
right.
between the voting bloc, it does set the tone, and it gets the momentum going. So you look at something like, you know, Three Billboards, which we've talked about extensively on this show, is my favorite movie of the year.
You said that.
I was, you know, it was great to see it. Won Best Picture, one for Frances McDormand, Sam Rockwell winning. That does indicate that it's picking up a lot of momentum and it's being taken seriously as a Best Picture multiple awards contender. And Gary Oldman for Winston Churchill.
Right. All I have to do is just watch the commercial for that, and you know he's won the Oscar.
You do.
Because it doesn't look like him.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah. And you're like, okay, all right, you go, okay.
So you're thinking, like, just Photoshop, like, the cigar in one hand and the Oscar in the other.
Yeah, might as well. I mean,
we shall fight in the Beverly Hilton.
Right. There's not, well, I mean, they should just pass that one over that night and save the time, because that's what it's going to be. I'll tell you, you know, one that is going to be stunning, I think, you know, by all accounts, the movie that that would be sort of a theoretical favorite would be The Post. Mm-hmm. Because you got Streep, you got Hanks, you got Spielberg, you got the whole
right.
thing.
Free speech
and right. Yeah, and it's that. And it's at a, I went to go see it this weekend, and there was rousing applause. And
really?
You don't get to see applause in the middle of a movie.
I'm glad to hear that's what the crowd was reacting to.
Yeah.
That's neat.
There's a moment, there was rousing applause at the end, but there was a moment in the middle of the film where they decide that they're going to go after the White House, despite the fact that Katharine Graham could lose, spoiler alert, could lose the newspaper if she does. Uh-huh. The crowd goes nuts.
Really?
And you know, very rarely, it's like Star Wars,
that's
right?
Cool. Is when I love that. Love hearing that.
But I think the movie's not going to end up being that. It's so, you know, Spielberg romanticism that Three Billboards, movies like that, that have got a little bit more grit, are going to appeal to a younger audience and are going to.
I think
you're
right.
Voting in the Oscars is getting younger.
It is. I think you're right about. I think that's exactly right. I think there's a lot of goodwill toward The Post, and it could be one of those films that gets like 7 or 8 nominations, but maybe gets shut out.
Yeah.
Of the actual wins. I think you're spot on with that. It is beautiful the way he does it, though. Even a newsroom looks so beautifully romantic with that Spielberg diffused light that comes through the windows. Yes. Because I remember when I was at the Sun-Times, not that quite that long ago, but late 80s, early 90s, and the coffee stains and the cigarette and the nicotine and all that weren't quite as beautiful as they
cigarette
were.
Cigarette haze. Yeah. Well, you did have a nice newsroom, though, because it overlooked the river, and there was a lot of sunlight. It had a southern exposure.
Actually, it kind of did. And, you know, we had those pneumatic tubes where you'd put the copy in there and you'd shoot them down to the... Because we were also, like the Post, a newspaper that had the printing presses on the physical site. If people might remember this, you could walk through the breezeway there
and see the print presses.
North Wabash, and you'd see the presses running.
And the building would vibrate, and they do that in the
yes.
Post. There's a lot of...
Yes, it would.
It was a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful... I think you said, I'm now quoting you, but it was a love letter to newspaper journalism.
Mm-hmm.
And in that respect, it's great. But I was not surprised at all last night that they sat there, you know, next to the Oprah table waiting to be called, and nobody got called.
Almost getting up, but
and
really getting the opportunity.
And Meryl Streep was just about to lean on the table, and I sat back down.
Yeah.
Did you like how Oprah and Stedman had, like, the floor seats you get for NBA games? Like, they're ahead of even the front table. Like, that's the only time in the
Jack Nicholson seat.
The Nicholson seat. Like, that's the only time ever that anyone has looked over their shoulder to say hi to Steven Spielberg at a Hollywood event since 1975, right? He's just
true.
Behind them. Hi, I'm in the normal front row. And they're in, like, the new seats that were created for, like, the Ball family. You know?
And then everybody had to say hello to Oprah because she's sitting right in front. And she's with Barbara Streisand, mm-hmm. who's really there just to be with Oprah, right?
Yeah.
I mean, as Barbara Streisand, she...
Well, she was. What is she, a presenter? Was that what she was just last night?
And she doesn't. I don't think she sticks around. She does that. You know, I'm the largest star of all, the greatest star of all. Barbara Streisand.
But she had to be there for the whole night.
She did have to be there. Normally, she doesn't even sit in the audience. She did sit in the audience. So I think this shows solidarity with the women, because normally she'll just, you know, this, she'll just swoop in.
Yes.
And go and swoop out.
Yes,
she's a swooper.
I'm familiar with her swooping.
You've seen her swoop.
I've been the breeze of the swoop has happened. You know, I've caught the
breeze.
Barbara breeze. No way.
That doesn't sound right.
She was lovely.
She is one of the most
we've had the great honor of meeting a lot of stars over the years, and she was. Absolutely, unbelievably nice and accepting and lovely. I mean, you know, we talked to her for 45 minutes.
That's amazing.
She has a reputation for being not that, but she was completely that, especially that night. But she sits there with Jim Brolin, who she's been with forever, right?
Yeah,
absolutely.
And
long time now.
You know, and they look like. If the way we were actually happened, it's the way it would have been. You know, sort of like that. It's kind of that moment.
But they're the striking couple, right? In their 70s, I guess, now. You know, let's put it this way. Her rogue son-in-law, the bad boy, you know, Josh Brolin, is like 54 at this point, right?
He's playing right on the edge of Social Security.
Who's a great character too, but
All right, back to what happened last night. I got a little... I think until Oprah got up, everybody was kind of wildcatting. Everybody had their own interpretation of what that night was going to be.
Yeah.
And so some people were taking it more seriously. You know, again, it's a TV show. So Seth Meyer tried to set some kind of a tone of the award show comedy and all that. He had tried, a lot of it fell flat, couldn't get through it. Mm-hmm. Some people were up there, you know, kind of angry, and then some people were just, you know, it ran the gamut from indignant to simple angry to, I'm not quite sure what to do up here, but I got to do something that's very respectful of the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And then everybody had a different kind of tone. And then Oprah got up there and made it, and this was, I think, a moment of, you know, I'm not easy as you are not either, Richard, to immediately jump and go, Oprah's a genius every time. But in this case, she did something that was really special because she found a way to coalesce this thing, make it about the moment, the zeitgeist, about the elephants in the room and in that room and in the nation, which are different elephants, really, in a lot of ways, but all kind of tied together about power structures and how do we treat each other.
Mm-hmm.
And she wrapped her arms around the entire issue and said, and basically called for a return to civility and understanding And not progress in a political way, but progress in a social way of saying, we, you know, we are a multicultural nation. We have been built by people who look different, and everybody has brought a little something different to the table. We are inclusive, unlike Europe was, you know, where everybody had to be. And we're, you know, we're not the ethnic cleansers. We're the ones who go in to fight the ethnic cleansers. Mm-hmm. And without saying these words, mm-hmm. she called on this culture to put its arms around each other and to try to find solutions that, of commonality as opposed to borders. And yes. and I don't mean borders with Canada or Mexico. I mean just border. You know, whose team are you on? We're trying to do tamp down the tribalism, and it was brilliantly performed.
I couldn't agree more. I think it was one of the high points of her public life, and you know she's had a lot of them. And as you mentioned, you know certainly we've taken you know umbrage and criticism of certain things she said and done. But in this case, you know she thought about what she wanted to say. She wrote something. She clearly had it memorized, but can also just speak off the cuff like nobody's business. Mm-hmm. And really, it was a groundbreaking moment. I think people will remember that a lot longer than they'll remember most of the other thing. I do like, too, also that that some of the women said, okay, I'll wear black, but not a lot of black, okay?
Oh,
we're going to get easy on the black.
We're going to get to that in just a second. Because
the red carpet was some of my favorite moments from last night.
I think that there were some moments where they're like, still look at me, look at me, look at me.
Oh, yeah.
Sharon Stone, hello.
Give me those scissors.
Is it about the cause?
That sounds Chris Sale went after his throwback jersey. Have we seen such cutout work?
Violetta's got the WGN Driver Trouble Spots.
Boy.
All right, we are talking Golden Globes with Richard Roper. What does this say about the Oscars? Very quickly here, sir.
I think at three billboards outside Ebbing, Missouri, I think, first of all, it's going to have a lot more people going to see it in theaters, which mm-hmm. they'll find out it's a great film. And we've firmly established that Frances McDormand and Gary Oldman, I think, are going to start taking victory laps here as the best actress and best actor. I think the supporting acting categories are still a little bit up for grabs. I'm not so sure Sam Rockwell will win for sure. I think Alice and Janney is very, very strong in I, Tonya. People should check that out as well. But I think right now what you're looking at is three billboards outside Ebbing, Missouri. Just think of it as three billboards. It's all you have to remember when you go buy your ticket.
So I think the race now is Shape of Water and three billboards.
Shape of Water is a beautiful film. It's, oh man, I don't know. It's a strain. I mean, it's a woman falling in love with a sea monster.
Right. But there,
which is like going on in Harvey Weinstein's yacht just a couple of months ago.
See what
you see what I mean? You can't.
All right. All right. Well, we wish everybody the best of luck on Harvey's yacht.
Oh, gosh.
That's right.
Looking forward to seeing what Sharon Stone, Kate Hudson, and Margot Robbie wear to the Oscars.
Yeah. Well, now they're free to wear nothing if they'd like. All right. We've got Judy Pilak standing by. She's got the 5 o'clock news coming your way in 2 minutes. Con Show with Anna DeVlantis. Richard Roper is here. We're going to do a little top five.
Yep.
If you were a betting man, Richard, I know you're not, but if you were, would you go with the three billboards to win the Oscar?
Yes.
Probably going to be 2-1, 3-1.
Yeah, I think it'll be about a 2-1 in your favorite. And I think it's the kind of movie that when people see it, they go, oh, okay, now I understand. It's just one of those movies, 5 minutes into it, you go, this is an Oscar-quality film. It just has the look and feel of it. Mm-hmm. Right
off the bat. You said it when it came out.
Yeah, when I saw it, I really didn't know much about it.
It was an October release to it.
Yeah, it was kind of a quiet release. It's done pretty well, though, because it did it the right way. Quiet release, let the reviews come rolling in, let people tell other people about it, get the awards going. So it'll be one of those movies that'll quietly make a nice profit, because it didn't cost much to make. You know, a lot of fine actors, but they're not, you know, they're getting a piece of the gross, maybe. Nobody's getting paid $10 million to be in that movie. Mm-hmm. Woody Harrelson.
So, if you were a betting man, how would you play the national championship game tonight?
Well, that was a conversation we were just all having down here.
Because
the three of us are not betting people.
No. But if you were.
Well, I'll tell you this much. The White Sox are 75-1 right now, Kev. So just for a dollar, you could win $75 to win the World Series. I'm just moving to pitchers and catchers reporting already.
Okay, we're
right past football, basketball,
and
hockey.
A few weeks away.
I'm conflicted. I think Alabama is going to, the tide is going to roll on the dogs.
It's tough to go against. They do feel like the 33rd NFL team, don't they?
I'm picking the upset tonight.
Good man.
I would take everybody on Alabama and put them in a Bears uniform for next year.
I would too, quite frankly. Can we get Saban too?
Yeah. And then we get to keep Mitchell Trubisky.
So who'd they hire? Kev? They hired the guy that forgot to give the ball to the NFL's leading rusher in the last three quarters of the game the other day when the Chiefs blew the lead. That's who the Bears hired?
Yeah,
that
but
guy?
Reports okay. came out that he wasn't calling the plays for the second half of the game, that it was back to Andy Reid.
Okay, then I'm okay. Then I'm on board.
Because according to one report...
I'm not calling for the firing of this guy yet.
Matt Nagy actually...
give us a week.
put together the first 15 plays because Andy Reid was giving him more time to prepare for his Bears interview.
Okay.
Oh, come on.
What?
Yeah.
No. Oh, here we go.
That is a cover-up if I have ever heard one.
That's it. I'm back on Nagy watch. I don't know if he's going to last. I don't know if he's going to last.
He loves to use running backs, so I think that's good news for Jordan Howard and Tariq Cohen.
Okay.
And he doesn't have a monkey.
He does not have a monkey, as far as we know.
But he and Trubisky will grow together.
Just think, if he has one good season, he could have more wins than Fox did in his entire career with the Bears.
Pretty much.
What did 13, right, total?
14 in the past 14. 3 years.
Okay, think of a year and a half.
Yeah, a year and a half, and you could surpass Fox.
Nagy watch, though. I don't know. I'm sure OB will have something to say about
that. Well, like I said earlier, you got to be skeptical about everything the Bears do these days because they just seem to screw up.
What's his contract like? Because that Vegas coach Gruden got like the record-breaking $100 million over 10 years. And that
He got the same contract Mariah Carey got, Gruden.
I'm like, that's a coaching contract.
It's a Vegas residency worth $100 million.
Yeah, it's essentially what it is.
What the heck?
Yeah, it was a marketing move, part of it for the Raiders.
Sure.
Without relevant.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I think it made sense. We don't know Nagy's the details of his contract yet.
I'm sure he's not.
And you're pulling a guy out of retirement who had become is kind of iconic in the booth. I mean, everybody got to get to know John Gruden.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it became in a different way than we'd known him as just Chucky,
exactly.
The crazy-eyed guy on the sidelines.
He did a lot of that stuff, like where he'd sit down with a quarterback and
which was
break
great.
Down the film. Great
it
stuff.
Was really
sort
great.
Of like Tony Romo. Everybody loves Tony Romo now. Yeah. Who knew he was Paul Rudd, basically?
And the, Tony Romo's great in the movie.
I love him. I love his
They should hire him.
Yeah.
Now, he'd be the quarterback coach.
I think it's interesting, though. Is that and Gruden is a great marketer because he's got like all these replicants that have his name. I think they're his kids, but I don't know. But there's like a Gruden. Every NFL team now has a Gruden working for it.
There's a lot of them out there.
And the guy never really stepped away from the game. I mean, one, he was a broadcaster, but two, it was in Hard Knocks, which HBO did. He was talking about how he actually still has a playbook. And then they're like, for what team, coach? He's like, no, I just like to have a playbook. And he designs plays still and has like his own John Gruden playbook.
He's a perfect guy for that.
He is.
I mean, as Raiders fans, and I know, Rich, you're among them, Raiders fans, this is a tough move. Man moving from Oakland to Las Vegas for them, but they got to do something. They want to make it America's bad boy team, and Gruden is the right guy to do that.
Absolutely.
So that's the but.
Speaking of betting, though, how dangerous is it to give somebody $100 million and then launch them into Vegas?
I'm a little bit more worried about the 21-year-old rookie.
Yeah, that's
stopping
true.
Off at places with names like the Spearmint Rhino.
All right. Let's go.
Now, it's the top five at five on the Rokon Show with Anna Tavlantis. Sponsored by the Hip and Knee Center, where they help you feel new again.
Ready?
Yes.
Yes.
Get on with it.
All right, I will. We're going to move along
number
quickly.
Number five.
But honestly, some of this, I can't even comment. I'm just going to let the top five speak for itself today.
It's kind of one of those
Fantastic.
Days.
Because it basically does. Here is Lindsey Graham. This morning on The View, he's a senator, as you'll recall, from South Carolina.
Oh, yeah.
The one Trump gave out his phone number.
Oh, right. That's
right. And now they're besties.
Mm-hmm.
Because as Lindsey Graham said yesterday, so George Stephanopoulos is like, well, what do you do? Why are you, you guys were enemies. Why are you together? And Lindsey Graham basically said, because I need his signature on a bunch of my own legislation, and he'll do it.
Using him to get the legislation passed.
Yes, that's apparently what it is. what about this stable genius thing, Lindsey Graham?
Do you think he's like really smart and a stable genius?
I think this, if he doesn't call himself a genius, nobody else will. So, the first thing that I want to tell you, he beat me like a drum. He ran against 17 Republicans and crushed us all. He ran against the Clinton machine and won.
Yeah.
So all I can say is you can say anything you want to say about the guy. I said he was a xenophobic, race-baiting, religious bigot. I ran out of things to say. He won.
He wasn't wrong, though. That was the thing.
Well, that is some way of answering whether or not you think he's a genius. Well, I did call him all these terrible things.
And he didn't take them back.
Yeah.
He's just friends with them now.
Oh. Yeah. Okay. See, again, what else can one say?
Politics.
Number four.
Michael Wolff, he's the guy written the book.
Oh, yeah.
He was confronted by NBC's Katie Turr regarding the factual errors in Fire and Fury. Now, Turr said that Wolff should release the audio tape that he's got, that any of the recordings of interviews that he did for the book, just to try to clear some of this stuff up. And he now says he's going to treat this book like any other piece of reporting, meaning he expects readers to trust him despite all of the errors.
You have tapes. Are you going to release the tapes?
No, I'm going to do, you know, I have what every journalist, I work like every journalist. I have tapes, I have notes.
But if people are questioning it, why not produce the evidence?
Because that's not what I'm not in your business. My evidence is the book. Read the book. If it makes sense to you, if it strikes a chord, if it rings true, it is true.
If it rings true, it is true.
This is where we are.
This is the problem.
This is where we are.
And he's calling himself a journalist.
Yeah.
This is the problem. This is that. I mean, the president can make stuff up. He can make stuff up. And if we live in this fantasy land, how are we ever going to get? Are we ever really going to establish reality again? How are we going to do that?
Oh, that's true. And then Nora O'Donnell also asked him this morning, did you speak with any of the members of the president's cabinet? And he said, I did not. Did you speak with the vice president? He said, I did not. It's hard to know, well, who did he speak with? Apparently, he spoke for 3 hours with the president, but the president denies it, and he says that there wasn't really interviews. It was just passing comments or something like that.
Okay, a couple of important notes here. First of all, I don't think that the president is demented or stupid. I mean, he is what he is. We see what he is. It's pretty.
He shows you.
He shows you every day what he is. Mm-hmm. He's got this really high EQ, this ability to figure out where people's weaknesses are and exploit them. He knows how to insult you so that you really start to question yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, there's people who are impervious to insult, and they go, I don't care what you say about me. I know how I feel about myself. But most people aren't like that. He knows how to play that. He knows what is going to make people tick, and he probably, Adam Kinzinger was just on with us a little bit ago. He said he's met with him on North Korea. He's very facile with the facts and the policies of international diplomacy and all that. He gets it. I think all that is true, and I don't think he's demented. I don't think he's got Alzheimer's or anything like that. I think he's just kind of nuts.
Yeah, I think that's about it. And also, he has no qualms about using people. He never has, so he doesn't have any guilt about throwing people off the train or under the bus when it suits him. So, and for someone in his position, that's not necessarily a weakness.
There are some moments in the book, though, that you can see being true. Did you hear that he mentions that Bannon removed furniture, and especially comfortable furniture, in the Oval Office because he didn't want anybody to be comfortable?
Right.
He didn't want that many people to gather there. There's no conversations. They were going to be talked to and not with.
Yeah, well, that's true.
And you sort of think, it seems like his style.
Yeah. All right, wait, there's one more Michael Wolff cut here.
Do you think he's sexist?
Yes.
Do you think he's racist?
Yes. Yes.
Xenophobic?
I do. Xenophobic. What does that mean? He's...
Afraid of the other.
Yeah.
Anti-Semitic?
I've had this specific discussion with Steve Bannon, who thought not. He thought, yes, maybe he's a
Lots
racist.
Lots of people accuse maybe Steve Bannon
Maybe he's a racist. He didn't think he was an anti-Semite. But I don't know. I think he's aware of who is Jewish in a way that feels creepy.
That's probably all very true.
As soon as you're keeping that count, part, you know, usually puts you in the anti group. You know?
Yeah, Jew, not a Jew. He's as anti-Semitic as Howard Stern, and I mean that's probably about where it sits. And you know what? And that the funny thing is that he's probably all a little bit of that xenophobic. Yeah, But here's the thing: how he personally feels, you know, the old some of my best friends are fill in the blank. It's the issue really is how he's playing the game here. He's playing the game to the people who are for sure and that vote on. I hate that other person because of who they are, and he's keeping that thing alive. So however he is personally, it's doesn't matter what he's doing, how he's doing what he's doing is dangerous to the nation.
He exploits hatred and fear,
yeah,
and racism when he says that the whites and the tiki torches had some good boys among them as well.
Even some of the other stuff. I mean, you know, like the Mexicans are, you know, just by saying the Mexicans are the bad Mexican hombres. Immigrants are the illegal aliens or, you know, whatever it happens to be. Because
wasn't a great landlord.
Whenever you have to say, I'm sure some of them aren't, but
I know,
you know, whatever, yeah, whatever it
good,
is.
There's some good non-rapists that. Coming across the borders as well. Yeah.
All right.
Bad hombres.
Yeah, and bad so hombres. It is what it is. Three, your two, your one, but first, Violetta. Okay, Rokan Show with Anna DeBlantis.
Yes.
Richard Roper is here. Top five of five is upon us. We're up to
number three.
Gary Oldman won the Golden Globe for Best Actor.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, of course, he's playing Winston Churchill in The Darkest Hour.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, he is.
Brief story. He told a brief story about meeting Harvey Weinstein in 1992 and why he refused to work with him back then. Mm.
Fortunately, he was never in my orbit. And we met him '92. He gave me the creeps, and I said, "Let's not work with that guy." And never did. I never did a Weinstein film. But when the curtain came down on that, I thought, I looked at it as it's evolution. A wheel is turning. There's another. You know, it's turning a notch in the evolutionary wheel.
Imagine how all the actresses felt.
You know, when he's talking about the weed there, he was married to Uma Thurman in the early 90s, who then eventually did work with Harvey.
Yes.
But they were divorced by then. So I think when he's saying, let's not work
with
him.
Pulp Fiction, a Miramax film?
Yeah, all of the Tarantino films, Kill Bill. So, you know, Uma had definitely, but she's definitely had some, not, you know, has said that he's a pig as well.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, I think, what he's referring to, because that would have been the time when he was married to Uma Thurman, where he's saying, let's not work with him. So maybe the whole time
he
was meeting Harvey, Harvey was looking at Uma's
Uma
assets.
Yeah.
Uma's Oprah. Oprah,
oh
Uma.
Goodness. Remember Oprah? Mm-hmm. Well.
See, now she has now lived down that moment at the Oscars.
There you go.
And now she has transcended.
That's right.
Where's Letterman now? Oh, he's coming back.
He's coming back. That's he's right. got his new show, right? What is it, Netflix?
It's on Netflix.
All right, here we go. Here's speaking.
Number two.
Oprah was bestowed the Cecil B. DeMille Award on Sunday. An honorary
but
award.
But no one noticed.
She got a trophy on top of everything else.
For this is from the Hollywood Foreign Press for outstanding contribution to the world of entertainment.
Oh.
That's about, she thinks
sure.
she gets that.
Sure,
she is
absolutely.
Actually a great actress.
She's a wonderful actress.
Isn't she going to be in something coming up, too? I thought she's got
she
an
is.
Ava DuVernay.
I think she's in A Wrinkle in Time, the much anticipated.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's in that.
Right. So, I mean, that's the thing, is that you kind of expect, and when they showed her last night, when they showed, like, her, you know, from The Butler and all the other stuff, it's always a nuanced performance. I mean, you know, she, in The Color Purple, I mean, she just blew through that, like, and you're like, oh my God, that's the time, really?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, she's deserving of this. There is absolutely no question about that. But, but it's, now it's being seen at a moment in which we know soaring, inspirational rhetoric about reconciliation is not in vogue in American politics at the moment. So her making this speech was refreshing to a lot of people. Now, she elaborated on this backstage.
And one of the reasons why I wanted to tell Recy Taylor's story is to let people know it's been happening for a very long time when people didn't feel that they could speak up. And so there are so many women who've endured so much and remained silent and kept going because there was no other recourse. And now that we've all joined as one voice, I think that feels like empowerment to those women who never had it.
This is one of the reasons she cannot run for president.
What?
Because she sings 20% of her sentences.
That's okay. It's powerful.
She's got more voices than Jim Carrey. That would talk about people. If you want, because, you know, she'll do the thing. I just had some buttermilk pancakes.
But you listen.
You're right. I think it's about 20%. And then the different accents. She goes down home.
Right.
Although Barack did that occasionally too.
When
got
she
that from her.
When right. she talked about
I think
all
he did. I think he did.
He might have learned some of his cadence. When she talked about the girls watching at home, though, was I mean, my gosh, there were people. I just kind of teared up a little bit because you thought about her sitting on her linoleum floor, as she described when Sidney Poitier won the Oscar in 1964, and that how it just made her realize that things can be different, and that you would think that 30 years from now, maybe there's some young girl who's going to cite Oprah's speech potentially based on just what it means.
I thought that was interesting when she said that last night. I thought, okay, that's kind of true, but it's also a different world. Even though it doesn't feel like it now, there's already been an African-American president. There's already been, there is a lot more inclusion at the highest levels of the culture, the society, the economy, and all that, that is very different than it was in 1964. Very different. And so, the idea of being able to watch this in entertainment, to see African-Americans in entertainment, is not novel.
But she's the first black woman to win this award. And
believe me. Can you name one other Cecil B. DeMille award winner?
But if you go through Hollywood's record right now, it's not all that great either when you have Barbara Streisand, the only best director who's female in the history of the award, right? So there are a number of...
Well, in the history of that award, of the Golden Globe, right?
That's right.
Well, it is true, though. I mean, the guy that won for This Is Us, it was the first time a black man had won in that category.
And Aziz
it is
Ansari,
a little amazing.
First Asian. I mean, it's like,
that looked like an outtake from Parks and Rec, because he was always, Tommy Haverford was always fantasizing that he'd win a Golden Globe in a velvet suit one day. And there
but
he's great, by the way. That's a terrific show. If you get a chance to check it out, Master.
All right. Hold on one second. But here, there's more.
Oh.
There's more. Here is Senator Orrin Hatch just minutes ago saying to TMZ what he thinks about Oprah running for president.
Okay.
That'd be great. She's a great soul.
Do you think she would have a chance for defeating President Trump?
I think a lot of people would consider her because she's a winner.
Do you think she could bring both parties together for her stance?
Well, that remains to be seen. That'd be a tough job. It's a real hard job. I'd like to sit down with her and help her if I could.
Enjoy the Rhodes Scholar from TMZ asking the hard-hitting questions of the senator.
Somehow they get the news.
What is that all about? Wait. Isn't he best friends with Donald Trump now? Didn't Orrin Hatch
nice?
Remember Donald tried to get him to run again?
Not anymore. And it went Newt. Or not Newt, Mitt.
Oh, my gosh.
Where's Newt?
Newt, Mitt, Mitt, Newt.
All right. And finally.
Number one.
At the Television Critics Press Association tour in Pasadena today, Jimmy Kimmel was asked if he was on board with the idea of Oprah for president.
Given the choice between Oprah and our current president, I'm on the bus with Oprah, traveling the country, encouraging people to sign up and vote. We would have to call her President Winfrey also. You realize that. We would have to really start using the word Winfrey a lot, which I don't know if we're prepared for that as a country.
President O.
Yeah, okay.
They'd still call her President Oprah.
I think so, too.
It was a speech at the Golden Globes, people.
Well, listen, the guy that fired Omarosa 3 times is in there now, so it doesn't seem so wacky anymore.
Top 5 at 5.
It's a very formal version of this, isn't it? All right. That's how we go. All right. The Air Force is in town, and General Merrill McPeak is with us. Nice. And it's a great honor to have him. And he's you might remember him from flying. I think you might have flown an air show in Chicago at the very beginning of your career, General. I appreciate that because you were with the United States Air Force Thunderbirds. And I'll bet you did at least one show here in Chicago.
Yep, along the lakefront. I had to dodge those boat masts along the lakefront there in Chicago.
And a couple of the buildings along the way there, too, which
we were looking down on the air show.
Right, that tend to jut out. We know, in general, thank you very much. A great and amazing Chief of Staff of the United States Air Force, an amazing career, an amazing service to the United States. So we thank you for that. And you've got a book out. You've got actually a series of books out, Roles and Missions, and you've got is the new one. And it's part of a three-part series here. It, probably one of the most comprehensive looks at your career and the state of the United States Air Force and the state of the United States military and Department of Defense, the Pentagon, over the last 40 years. So thank you, sir, for that as well. Let's talk about where we stand right now. When I would drag you right in. We had Congressman Kinzinger, also Air Force, by the way, I might point out, on with us a couple of hours ago, and we were talking about North Korea. And he was not optimistic. He was hopeful, but not optimistic that maybe the conversations that are being had now between the North and South Korea as they pertain to the Olympics may lead to more conversations and a way to maybe break through this, what appears to be loggerhead here. What are your thoughts on that, General?
Yeah, I would be absolutely delighted if there was a breakthrough. I think it ought to be, you know, from our point of view, there ought to be very fruitful negotiations possible here. I'm afraid I'm skeptical also. Before I became chief of staff, I was in command of our Air Force out in the Pacific, and including units in Korea. So I've got, you know, experience going back 30 years on this subject. And I'm scratching my head here because this problem now threatens us in a very grave way, and we should have done something about it a long time ago. But
may I stop you, General, on that for just a second? Because it's interesting. I've heard the president say that. I've heard past presidents say that. What do you think could have been done, as obviously as you know, you were a front row seat to all this? At what point could we have done something, and what should we have done?
Well, I think the window of opportunity here has always been very narrow. And but during the time that I was in the JCS, we were saddling up to go do something about this in a military way when former President Jimmy Carter went to Pyongyang and negotiated what was called the reference agreement, under which we agreed to provide some fuel, oil, and so forth, and they put their nuclear weapons program on ice for a while. That was a possibility had we exploited it. There's a lot of things we could do. Look, we've never signed a peace treaty with these guys. It's still an armistice that runs back to 1953. Mm-hmm.
Right.
We could lift trade sanctions. We could give them diplomatic recognition and so forth. So there's a lot of cards in our diplomatic deck here, but we have to have a willing partner on the other side of the negotiating table. And so far that hasn't worked out very well for us. And with this guy, I'm even less optimistic than I have been sometimes in the past. So I think at the end of the day, we're going to have to do something because this nuclear program threatens U.S. cities in a real way. It has to be stopped. And if we can't do that through diplomacy, through negotiation, through economic sanctions and so forth, then I think we ought to intervene militarily and dismantle that nuclear capability. It's simply too much to expect that we'll continue to live forever under that kind of nuclear threat.
Is there a way to do that without risking U.S. cities or risking South Korea or Japan?
Well, first of all, I think we can. There's a time limit here. There's a fuse burning on this problem. I think we have 6 months to maybe a year on the outside to settle this problem before U.S. cities are really massively threatened.
Mm-hmm.
But there will be damage. If we intervene militarily, there will be damage, and it will concentrate on Seoul, where something like two-thirds of the wealth of South Korea is concentrated. Now, that's because they have dug in guns on the reverse slope of the hills just north of the DMZ. So they range Seoul with artillery now. And that means Seoul will be damaged. Now, how heavily? I don't know. The one thing about these gun positions, they're on rails. The guns are on rails, and they roll them in and out of these tunnels that have blast doors. So they're you know, going to be hard to go after. But the disadvantage to those guns is that they are at known locations. I mean, they're at geo-coordinates. They're not moving targets. And if we put a 2,000-pound conventional bomb within 10 meters of those blast doors, they're not going to open again. So I think we could go to work on that target set. It will take a while because there are thousands of these artillery pieces, but not all of them are in range of Seoul. The ones that are in range of Seoul are the ones we'd have to go to work on first.
Do you think it's inevitable, I'm sorry, sir, that a military solution will in fact happen here, and that would be a way out of this, or what sort of retaliation could that potentially lead to?
I don't regard it as a way out, but I do regard it as virtually inevitable. The way out here is for the North to agree to dismantle their nuclear weapons program under international inspection. And there are a variety of carrots that we could offer in a serious negotiation. I think everything ought to be on the table to negotiate. I think we ought to try everything, try to get the Chinese to help, try to get the Russians to help. At the end of the day, I don't think anything will work except military force. And that is, after all, why we have a Pentagon, why we have military forces, is to protect us from precisely this kind of threat. I mean, I don't know what could be evaporated today. Maybe Guam. But tomorrow it's Honolulu, and the next day it's Seattle, and then it's Chicago.
Right.
So, I mean, we have to act on this, and we have to act in a reasonably near term. And my conviction is it probably will have to be military action.
It is interesting that it does seem like the military posture that we're standing with now. You talked about the Pacific Air Force, which you were the commander at one point, and that is based at in Hawaii. And it's interesting that there does seem to be a little bit of a run up of security there and concern. I don't think the people in Hawaii, I just got back from there, I don't think the people in Hawaii that I was speaking to who are, live there are any more concerned than they have ever been. As you know, General, that's a place that wears with great honor the fact that it was attacked and that it recovered and that it was Hickam Joint Base now is a very much a it's a very proud place. And they're ready to, to take on all comers. And it does seem to me that there is, though, a little bit more grit in the teeth, because there's this notion that maybe they are going to be targeted, or, maybe Elmendorf up in Alaska is going to be targeted, or some other kind of thing. But that seems to me to be a foolish thing. If Kim Jong-un really has the capability, taking out a military base that he's going to be then certainly annihilated for, I'm not sure if he's a rational actor or not, but I assume he is. Do you assume he is?
No.
And where?
Look, I hope you're right, but the consequences of your being wrong in that judgment are we lose Chicago.
Right.
I'm not interested in trading Chicago for wishful thinking here. If there's even a 5% chance that he's not rational, that's too big a chance for us to take.
Is there a way for us to know? I mean, obviously, you were the chief of the Air Force and you were a member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So, what you can discuss with us, is there enough? Do you get the sense that there is intelligence that would tell us that?
I'm very uncertain about the intelligence on their nuclear infrastructure. For one reason, I've been out of the business for 20 years. So, I haven't seen anything like the latest figures. The last test they did, a missile test, was with a mobile missile. Now, that's a very tough target, mobile missiles. But a lot of the nuclear infrastructure has got to be at known locations, and you don't have to knock it out, all of it. You have to disable it. Knock out 15% or 20%, 50% of it, and the program stops because it's interlocked and they all have to, every factory depends on the output of the previous factory. So I believe we can dismantle effectively their nuclear infrastructure a relatively straightforward way with conventional munitions. I don't believe we should use nuclear weapons in any kind of attack of the kind I'm describing.
Right.
So we would do a decapitation attack, which would be aimed at the political authorities, the decision makers. We would dismantle their nuclear infrastructure to the extent that we have good intelligence on that. We'd go to work on these artillery pieces that range Seoul, and we'd eliminate their, obviously, their air defenses, so we could do all that at minimum risk. I think that's all doable. Does the South get damaged in that process? They sure do. And how badly they get damaged depends on how quickly we can carry this sort of an attack out and how well planned it is and so forth. And all that is a question mark.
Right.
But in any case, if we have to do a serious rebuild of Seoul, I prefer that to seeing Seattle disappear.
Sure.
You know, I mean, I'm very concerned about this. And my interest is, as an American, I wore the U.S. uniform. If I was wearing the uniform of the South Korea air chief, whose predecessors I knew pretty well, by the way, and they're all good guys, I'd be maybe making a different case. So,
pretty certain that's true, General.
About what is in our best interest.
Yeah, I understand.
That's
I understand. Yeah. All right, General, thank you so much. I hope we get a chance to talk to you again. General Merrill McPeak.
Okay, Ro. Thank you, Anna.
Thanks, General.
Nice talking to both of you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
Glad you guys are above freezing, finally.
Yes. Trust me, General, we are too. Thank you.
Okay.
All right. Roles and Missions is the new book by him.
Yeah, very sobering conversation there.
Yep. All right. Let us now talk to Violetta Powdermatic, WGN Traffic Trouble Spots.
Go ahead.
The Rokan Show with Anna DeVlantis right here, 720 WGN. All right. By the way, I don't know if you have seen this, but we like to talk about that LeVar Ball guy because he makes all kinds of trouble in the world.
Big baller.
Big baller brand. Well, it turns out that the Better Business Bureau, Big Baller Brand is BBB, and Better Business Bureau is BBB, and the Better Business Bureau BBB just gave Big Baller Brand BBB an F- for their rating.
Oh, gee.
Steve Burness, LeVar Ball showdown.
Ooh. My money's on Steve, by the way.
Because it turns out that the Big Baller Brand, when you go to buy the $350 shoes.
Yeah.
Isn't that like the entry point?
Just about there. They go all the way up to like 500 or 700.
Yeah.
They have sandals at 220.
Okay.
Just so you know.
So you get the Zoe or you get the whatever it is. It sometimes they don't show up. And sometimes they just forget to send you shoes. And if they do send you shoes, it sends you the wrong time. Just something to know. I'm so glad it's not me anymore. I could just go home to my monkey.
I miss Coach Fox.
I thought Gidget passed away, Coach Fox.
I got another one.
You got another monkey. That's
Gidget
exciting.
Gidget too.
Don't tie it to a tree outside.
My brother did that.
Is that what happened to poor monkey?
The monkey had a heat stroke when they were down in Florida, and they tied it to a tree in the backyard, and it died.
Let me tell you a little story.
Okay. Well, Coach, allegedly, John Fox was at a little camp.
I was at camp.
Oh, he's
and
a
I
camp.
Came home, and I ran around the house. Where's Gidget? Where's Gidget?
Looked under your bed, in the closet.
Everywhere.
Yeah.
And I found out that my dope brother tied Gidget to a tree and Gidget a lot of fur. Very hot outside and humid.
Yeah.
Gidget is a highland monkey, not a lowland monkey. How stupid was Jeff not to know that?
Yeah, he found out the hard way.
That's tough. That's a really sad story.
Gidget would swing and do all kinds of fun things.
Could he catch a football?
John Fox drawing routes for the monkey. All right, go along, Gidget.
Just get open. That's all I tell Gidget. Get open. And I throw the ball, and she maybe catch it, maybe not. I'm used to that.
All right.
It's where it all started.
It is where it all started. Yeah. All right. Well, John Fox isn't there anymore. Now it's a guy who's mispronouncing his own last name. And our own Adam Hogue is going to correct that problem tomorrow. Hopefully it's Nagy. I don't know why we have to call him Nagy.
Nagy, right?
Nagy. Nobody with that name calls it Nagy.
Yeah, if you have that name, wouldn't you change it to Nagy? Nagy?
Nagy.
Nagy.
Not Nagy.
No. All right. What, are you going to fix this tomorrow, Adam, for us?
Well, I'm confused about this, too, now. Because I say Matt Nagy. Is that wrong?
Oh, it's Nagy.
No, you and Kevin are saying it right. We're saying it wrong.
Yeah. We want him to change it to Nagy, because Nagy, you don't want to have a guy that's like Nagy all the time. First of all, imagine what the headlines are going to be.
Yeah. You can, right? They write themselves.
Yes. You're in the big time now. This is his first head coaching job. He was a high school coach 10 years ago. And then he was out of the business for a little while, wasn't he?
Yeah, just a short time. Well, Adam, you can tell them.
Yeah. Tell the story of Mr. Nagy.
The Matt Nagy story.
Well, the story is that he got done playing arena football, and he got a real estate license, and he was doing real estate, just, you know, regular selling homes out in Pennsylvania, was coaching high school football on the side, was making good amount of money, and had to cut his pay by 2/3 when the Eagles and Andy Reid asked him to join their coaching staff. And so he had to make a big gamble there with four kids. He had four kids already at that time. He decided to cut his pay by 2/3 to dive head-on in the NFL coaching. And obviously now, I believe that was 7 years ago. Now, 7 years later, it has paid off as he's now the head coach of the Bears, probably making plenty of money now.
We don't know what yet, though, right?
No, the terms aren't out yet. We don't even know the years. Usually, well, it'll probably match up with Ryan Pace's contract in terms of the numbers, years wise.
Four years.
Right. Because let's face it. Because if this doesn't work, Ryan Pace got to go.
Exactly.
Ed Obradovich was. We actually had to put him in restraints and ship him out of town.
That's hard
to keep him from killing Ryan Pace.
That's really hard to do.
I have to be honest. My first thought when the Bears announced last week that Pace was getting a contract extension was, where's Ed Obradovich? Someone needs to check on him. Because he had to have been losing his mind just doing those post-game shows with him for the last, really, the whole second half of the season. Those guys were all over Pace, and I was worried when they announced that he got extended.
Well, on the surface for me, Adam, this appears to you check all the boxes we had kind of talked about leading up to this. A young guy, innovative on offense, can develop a quarterback. We have kind of been joking about it today, though, that anything the Bears do right now, it just seems like they're going to mess it up somehow. Right. But, you know, for the most part, this seems like kind of where the NFL's trending. We saw Sean McVay, the 31-year-old, what he did with the Rams, and everybody kind of wanted that. And that's sort of what you're hearing with Nagy, that he's energetic, he knows how to develop a quarterback.
Well, here's what we know. Offensively, I think this is an outstanding hire.
Yeah.
He's 39, which really doesn't matter. He's been in the league long enough to me. He's on the Andy Reid coaching tree. If you watch the Chiefs' offense this year.
So this is 7 years on the with Andy Reid?
Totally with Andy Reid the whole time. Was hired as a quality control guy. Got promoted. Went with him from Philadelphia to Kansas City. And then remember, Doug Peterson, who's now the Eagles head coach working with Carson Wentz, was the Chiefs offense coordinator before. That's where he got hired to Philadelphia. And it was Matt Nagy who got promoted and took over that spot. Now he gets Mitch Trubisky and the Bears job. So a couple of these guys from Andy Reid's coaching tree, well, we'll see about Doug Peterson, obviously having a ton of success. We'll see about Matt Nagy. But from this standpoint, it fits Trubisky. If you just watch the Chiefs offense, a lot of stuff that he's comfortable on the move, a lot of shotgun, spread type of concepts. And it should also be good for the Bears running backs. Now, can he command a locker room? Can he not screw up the timeouts in the two-minute drill? Can he actually
challenge into a turnover? Hopefully he doesn't do that.
Throw a challenge flag at the right time, which no Bears coach in the history
That's unfair.
Of the Bears.
I thought he had total control of the ball. I forgot that rule existed.
They sneak up on you, those rules.
We don't know. We don't know if he could do it because he's never been head coach. So
and my monkey died.
I think that's the biggest knock on him is that he was a quarterback coach up until recently and would then became offensive coordinator, last year, but didn't really start calling plays until well into the season. So people are saying, has he had this kind of a role? Is he ready? And I guess we'll see.
Okay.
But to me,
sounds so good to you, does it, Rob?
You don't need to call plays to be a head coach. So the fact that he didn't call plays until week 13 or whatever is doesn't really bother me.
He's still drawing up plays. As offensive coordinator, you got to put the book together so he knows how to draw up a play.
it sure sounds like he's going to be calling plays for the Bears next year. So that'll be obviously something to watch. But
well,
as
they're not
going
to leave it up to Mitch Trubisky yet, no. For sure.
Right. But he's going to hire an OC, and it's probably going to be someone that if he feels like he's not comfortable calling the plays at the same time as being the head coach, he'll probably put that on his offensive coordinator. So that's the least of my worries.
And what do you think he's going
to... There's just no way to know... Here's my priority right now, and I know I can report this. It's the Bears' priority right now as we're talking. Keeping Vic Fangio. His contract expires at midnight, and they're working on this. Matt Nagy wants to keep Vic Fangio, from what I understand. The Bears are trying to get this done today because he can start interviewing with other teams tomorrow. He basically becomes a free agent. And by the way, the Packers are one of the teams that want to talk to Vic Fangio.
But about a coordinator, the
DC job.
Yeah.
But that's worst case scenario. If you lose Vic Fangio to Green Bay, that would be terrible.
So what do you think happens there? You think they'll find a way to keep him on board?
I think that right now, if you look at the jobs that have come off the table, and just today the Raiders defensive coordinator job got filled and the Bengals defensive coordinator job got filled. Any talk of him going back to the Bay Area, right now the 49ers job isn't open and the Raiders job just got filled.
And also got moved to Las Vegas too. I don't know if they've heard.
That's true. That's true. So there is, to me, this is trending towards Vic Fangio staying in Chicago as he weighs his options here. As I look at it, the best chance for him to continue to have success is to keep coaching this defense that he has taken from dead last in the NFL to number 10 in 3 years. There's a lot of young pieces that seem to be trending upward. The biggest problem with the Bears right now is fixing the offense. So if I'm Vic Fangio and I'm going, oh, they just hired an offensive coach who loves Mitch Trubisky and can get the most out of that side of the football, I'm going to stay here. He's going to get paid a lot of money. He's going to work with his defense. And I think that this is the – so right now my guess is he's going to stay, but things are very fluid right now. Because remember, he did interview for the head coaching job and did just get passed up, and there are a ton of egos in the NFL.
You mentioned improving the offense, and if anybody needs a reason to watch tonight's game, other than the fact that it's probably going to be a good one, is that there's a receiver on Alabama that I've been watching closely this year, Adam, because that's clearly the position that needs to be addressed this offseason. Calvin Ridley, Alabama receiver, he's their star on offense. What are your thoughts on him, and where do you project him? I know you're probably starting to put together some mock draft stuff.
Because the Bears are 7, right?
Bears are, yeah.
They're 8th. They're 8th in the draft coming up.
Or are there any other players besides Ridley that Bears fans can be keeping an eye on that could potentially be here?
Yeah, well, there's a few names tonight. What's his name? Rokon Smith, is that it off the top of
my head? No relation.
The Georgia...
The linebacker, he's a monster.
The Georgia linebacker, watch him because he's definitely top 10 material. Calvin Ridley, though, who you asked about, is an interesting prospect because he's not going to be a go-up-and-go-get-it type Amari Cooper type player who came out of Alabama, but I'd say he's closer to Odell Beckham in terms of just being a really good route runner who's going to get open. And by the way, I think the Bears could use an Odell Beckham, so that's
That'd
fine.
That'd be fine. I think we'd all be okay
we'll
with that.
Him.
They could use me and Kevin as wide outs right
honestly
now.
It honestly wouldn't be that big of a drop-off.
Yeah.
it'd be an upgrade.
It might, yeah. I could drop a ball just as easily as any of the rest of those
sneaky
guys.
Quick, guys.
Now, I guess the... Right. They don't see that coming. Right. The thing is, how many of these guys are we going to get a Cam Meredith back next year? Are we going to get, I mean, what's the help they're going to need? The needs list of people who are allowed to touch the ball, non-receivers who are allowed to touch the ball, is pretty high here because they're going to need tight ends. They're down. I mean, Zach Miller is undoubtedly not returning.
Yeah.
Other than Cameron Meredith, I mean, who else is there?
Well, here's the first thing. They're going to get Cameron Meredith back, and he's going to have a lot to prove. He was entering a contract year, and his ACL really messed up things. Now he's restricted free agent, so they're going to bring him back because he's not going to have many other options coming off the knee injury. Kevin White is still under contract. Would I count on anything from him? No. He hasn't proven that he can stay healthy, let alone play, but it is a name to keep in mind there on the depth chart. First and foremost, though, you have 2 draft picks, 1 a tight end, 1 a running back, rookies that are now done with their rookie year. But Adam Shaheen and Tariq Cohen, I think, can take a pretty good step forward. We've already seen
Tariq
Cohen's
Tariq
good.
Cohen will, in this kind of an offense, of a Nagy
it's
offense.
It's perfect for Cohen.
I don't want to say, what's wrong with the Nagy offense? It's better than Nagy offense.
You can say Nags. I heard in Kansas City they called him that.
Nags.
Nags.
So Nags offense, Okay, it's growing on me. is that I got Tariq Cohen gets a pretty interesting featured position there, right? Because you're going to be able to he does have good hands, right? I don't know how in traffic it's not quite as good as it is when he's wide open, but I mean there's a guy that you know could be a really versatile weapon for you. We know he can be.
Well, Nagy just had Tariq Hill in Kansas City, and he found ways to use him, get him all over the field. Similar type player. I think Hill's more of a wide receiver than really a running back, but they're still kind of that hybrid type player that, look, you just get him on the field, you find ways to scheme him open, and that was one of my biggest gripes with his offense the entire year, was there were times where Cohen's not even on the field. He's the only guy in the entire roster that commanded extra attention from opposing defenses, and he was on the sideline more than he was on the field, and it was crazy. So I think that one of the biggest things Matt Nagy can do here is figure out a way to get Cohen open, figure out a way to get the ball to Adam Shaheen, who needs to toughen up and be more physical in year two. But even with him, I didn't think they gave him a good enough look, and when they did, it looked like he could play football. You fix those two guys in your offense, it takes the pressure off the wide receiver situation. Do they need to go out and get a wide receiver? Absolutely. I think Cam Meredith can play, but he's a number two, not a number one. They have to find a number one wideout as well.
Well, other than the draft, off the top of your head, do you have a top receiver free agent list that the Bears could not just draft, but they can just go sign someone and be an immediate impact on the offense?
Well, one name I like, and it'll be interesting to see if the Jaguars keep him around, is Allen Robinson, who could potentially – he's coming off a knee injury, so he's someone I could see not command a whole lot of money, but I imagine the Jaguars may franchise him. He's someone who's put up a ton of yards before he got hurt, and I think he could be a potential target. Jarvis Landry in Miami is another name. I will say, though, that the wide receiver list in free agency and the draft, this isn't a great year. Yeah. So that's working against the Bears. Alshon Jeffrey may have been once again the biggest name among the wide receivers, but the Eagles locked him up. But that just tells you kind of the situation that it is this year in free agency.
Well, you see the thing about Alshon Jeffrey, he was a Chicago Bear. And I'm not sure if you're aware of this.
That was my point.
They let him walk.
They did have him. I don't know.
Again, I'm available if you want to throw that out there to Ryan Pace and Nagy tomorrow, Adam, at the press guy. What time is the presser tomorrow? Have they announced that yet? I know it's TBD.
They have not. I'm assuming, knowing the Bears, they'll let us know by 1 a.m.
Oh, that's
maybe
nice.
1:30.
Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah. When they get around to it, this is really something, because I think a lot of Bears fans, and I count myself in this group, thought that there was an opportunity here because there is some talent on the team. There are obviously some holes, like a receiver. That's a big hole, and that's an important hole.
Yeah,
but there's some optimism because you've got a rookie quarterback that the rest of the NFL seems to also agree has real great potential. Well, and we thought that about Rex Grossman, too. And you know, Rex Grossman had a very durable career. He just never popped into superstardom, but he was a durable player.
Pieces on defense? A lot of pieces on defense.
A lot of pieces on defense. You got, you got Akeem Hicks. You got guys who are going to be, you have the potential for some Pro Bowlers there. I don't know. They may need some linebackers, which makes this very interesting.
I've been saying it all year, the receiver position, but man, Rokon Smith from Georgia, he's a Butkus Award winner. Watch him tonight, because him in the Rose Bowl, he was everywhere. So honestly, I wouldn't be opposed to taking someone like that and trying to fill the
and
receiver
I like the
position
idea of it, because I think it helps promote the show. But there is nothing, and I don't think we can kind of deal with him immediately.
Uh-huh. Rokon.
That would
Get
be, I kind of like the idea of that.
Sure.
But where do we now feel good that we're not starting from zero again? I just got that. I have this feeling. That's why I think a bigger name coach, that even a guy who's coming off of a bigger name that's coming, sort of resurrecting his career, whether it's a Jeff Fisher or somebody else that sort of steps in and is seen as a steady hand.
Yeah.
I think we're just more in rebuilding.
This seems more of a 3-year plan.
Yeah, and we just didn't we get done with a 3-year plan? We got another 3-year plan now. I got to start over again.
I think you need to there needs to be some energy here put into this offense. I mean, that's the biggest problem with this team, and that's where I go back to, if you can keep Vic Fangio and keep things steady on that side of the football and let Matt Nagy do
and give him Rokon.
And give him Rokon.
Yeah.
Rokon Smith.
Rokon Smith.
Take him.
Yeah. He's an animal.
Yeah. And then you're done on that side of the football. Hey,
yeah,
let me give you a name.
You're right.
I want to hear your opinion on this.
Yes, quickly.
I know the Bears have Jordan Howard. I know they have Tariq Cohen. Saquon Barkley is still there at number 8.
They've got bigger needs.
But do you take him to move something else? Because do you do, as Dicka told us, and there's a real name right there, Dicka.
Dicka. Yeah.
No T. Dicka. If he told us best player available on the board at the time, do you take him and then move him? Or you take him and then, you know, reshuffle?
I'd take him and put him in the offense. You saw, you know what?
Three running backs. We don't need no stinking wide receivers. We're going to play the single wing offense and we're going to do it right.
Well, you know what Zeke Elliott has done for the Cowboys?
That's true.
It's a different level with this guy, Saquon Barkley. I would put him in the offense.
Yeah, and Trubisky, you put him with Trubisky. Yeah.
The old T formation, bring it back.
Yeah, but you still need wide receivers.
Load up the backfield. Yeah.
It's right in the song.
That's right.
What song? All right, thank you.
Figure out how his name is pronounced.
Thanks,
tomorrow.
Hope. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Number one goal tomorrow. All right,
thanks, thank you, Adam. Here is Violetta with the last track report of the afternoon.